Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Welcome to a special membership drive edition of Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wigman. Today, my guests are two broadcast journalists, one local and one national. 50 years ago this month, an Immigration Act was passed that proved to be one of the most nation-changing events in our history. NPR correspondent Tom Gelton has written a book that is a major contribution to the ongoing discussion about immigration in America. The book is part political history, part intimate social narrative, and part economic and cultural analysis. Later in the hour, I'll be talking to Tom about this new book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. My first guest went to Iraq in 2003 as a U.S. Army broadcast journalist. Sylvia Bowersox was stationed in Mosul and Baghdad, but reported from coalition outposts around the country. She returned to Baghdad as a civilian, spending almost 2 years working in the U.S. Embassy as a State Department press officer. She received a B.A. in English from San Francisco State University and is currently completing an M.A. in creative writing at Chico State. She also wrote for a weekly Chico paper, Synthesis. Sylvia Bowersox won first place in the News and Review Poetry 99 competition, and one of her nonfiction essays earned a Pushcart nomination. In her book of prose and poetry, she walks the line between journalism and fiction. Its title, Triggers, is a warning. She's also a musician, and the name of her band is The People You Die With. Sylvia Bowersox, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm sure people are wondering, why did she join the Army?
Well, I come from a military family. My father was a 20-year Army officer. He did 3 tours in Vietnam. My mother also had been in the Air Force. She had been a supply sergeant. And I had tested my wings in the world and realized I wanted to serve my country. And so I joined the military.
Well, were you already a journalist when you joined the military?
Oh, well, I was kind of young and we were all kind of, I'm not sure what I am. So the military helped me figure it out.
Well, your book that we're going to be talking about has both poetry and prose in it. It's called Triggers. And you have a blurb on the back of your book from Dr. Ann Speckhard. And I've interviewed her. She's a delightful person, and she has written books that just make my jaw drop. And then yours even more so. Your book is equally amazing. How did you meet Dr. Speckhard?
Well, I worked in the embassy as a press officer during the IRMO, Iraq Reconstruction Management Office era, and her husband was in charge. He was the head Ermite, so I knew her because of him.
Well, for people who may not have heard interviews with Dr. Speckhard, she has written a book, Talking to Terrorists, and she has written a book about a transgender Navy SEAL, and she has written a book called The Bride of ISIS, and so she really is an internationally known expert in the field of terrorism. And so she says, your book, she's writing about your book, this is a must-read for anyone who wants to really understand and maybe even vicariously feel what serving in conflict really entails, wrenching from the gut up into the soul. And it really is. It was, when I started reading some of your poems, it would just take my breath away. And some of it is too strong even to read on air. But she says you get this feeling that you vicariously feel what it's like to be there in, for example, in Iraq. So I would like for you to read from your book. You have a poem called Baghdad Sand.
Oh, I love this one.
And if you would read Baghdad Sand for us.
Baghdad sand is talcum powder. It gets into everything. Eyes, lungs, engines, cameras, motors, hearts and minds, weapons, crotches, brains, everything. And it's red. Sandstorms turn the world red. Red like Mars, red like blood. You can feel your heart during the sandstorms, and you can't breathe. During the sandstorms, the land gets into you. After the storm finishes, you know that you've changed, and things will always be different. You belong to this land. It has claimed you. And you'll always want to come back to it, no matter what. I made friends with it, danced with its people, felt their love and their hate. They told me with a whisper that turned into a scream that God had made man out of the red sands of Iraq, and at any point he could unmake me. I believe them because I'm in Mesopotamia. I believe them because no one here can ever make up their mind for long, but they hate forever. And I believe that anything is possible here because I've seen it rain. When it rains and God's seed mixes with the feverish sand, the sand comes alive. It draws breath. It finds form and it sticks to you. It colors you and you can't brush it off. You can't scrub it off. You can't bake it off. It's got you. And that's all there is. Everyone ages quickly here, and the visitors grow so attached to the misery and the adrenaline and the excitement that all the fun in the world drains away. They forget that there are beautiful things and art and green grass and anything but the merry-go-round of work and bombs and parties and desperate people and more and more and more and more that must be done. This leaves only sand and dust and excrement and bombs and Blackhawks and stress and blood and emptiness. This war is addictive. It's heroin. It's nicotine and crystal meth. It's a bad lover with a full bank account. I need it. I need it. I want it. I miss it. I miss the vertigo. I need the vertigo. I miss the despair and need the despair. I need it all. We did something important, and we're important because we were willing to be there. Willing to be there when no one else was willing to be there. I miss knowing that I was part of something special because I showed up. We were a band of soldiers from Los Angeles, California, riding in the back of a deuce and a half, blazing down the 7.5 miles of scary highway called Route Irish. This special highway linked BIOP to the Green Zone. We had a backstage pass to meet the great and powerful Oz at Saddam's presidential palace in the sky. When Saddam was king, the presidential palace had been a torture chamber funhouse. It was big. It was beautiful. It was ours. We were moving in with the Coalition Provisional Authority, Ambassador Bremer, his ego, and all the Iraqis. We cleared Checkpoint 12 and drove into the land of the stadium-sized houses. It was Golden Gate Park without any water, grass, limos, or rich people with dogs. We looked, we pointed, we laughed, we were starstruck. We passed rows of bombed-out junior palaces. Someone said, look, Uday's Love Palace. According to the latest talking points from D.C., this real estate was the ultimate in all that was ugly and dangerous and wrong in the world. This was the place where the Ba'ath Party officials were the SS. They played canasta, pillaged, killed people, and cheated on their wives, while the rest of the country was a Netflix movie on pause. Our latest intel confirms that nobody was safe or innocent. They either caused the mess or were pushed into its acid pools. If you listen to the Iraqis, after they ferociously thanked you for giving them their freedom from Saddam Hussein, you would think that for 30 years, Iraq had been nothing but a huge amphitheater of people quaking in their boots, waiting in line for their turn at execution. We the few scaled the coalition version of the Great Wall of China and found ourselves in the Green Zone, furnished by the latest Star Trek movie, populated by soldiers, servants, and inmates of countries who had jumped into our furnace. Cheney gave them money, praise, and the promise of their very own sitcom after the war. In our welcome packet, under the cigarettes, the Ambien, the condoms, and the hand sanitizer, was the pamphlet entitled Coalition Declaration of Faith. This war is the war against terror, the war to end fear, the war to make things better and safe for democracy. You must never forget, the president's plan for success in Iraq is working. We arrived at the wounded knee of the country and took our place in the campaign to right the wrongs and heal the world and make everyone free. How are we to know that right at that moment, things were as good as they were going to be? While I was taking my next breath, the tide had turned, the milk had soured, and we should have gone home right then. This was our shining hour, and the golden day was ebbing into night, and the night would last forever. How were we to know that death and destruction, misappropriation, exaggeration, and full-fisted villainy had grown up here? It was the normal state of affairs, while our hopes were the aberration. By the end of the first 24-hour news cycle, we replaced Saddam the Horrible in the hearts and minds of the population, the headlines of the world, the confused protesters back home chanting, "Troops out now, troops 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 out now." We stayed. 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 We stayed because the sand wanted us to stay. 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 And that's all there is.
My guest is Sylvia Bowersox, and she's reading from her collection of prose and poetry, Triggers. Sylvia is a poet, a musician, and a journalist. And when you are writing this, you give it a musical quality, even in your prose. So it's a real joy to listen to you read just the prose that you're writing. Now, your last name is somewhat unusual. It is your husband's name. You took your husband's name when you got married. And there's a piece in your book where you thank, was it Baghdad or Iraq that you thanked? Or no, this is a piece that you wrote for Synthesis.
I did. I wrote about meeting my husband.
And
We met in Baghdad. I was his public affairs advisor, and he was the health attaché. He was active duty Air Force at the time, and I wanted him to do certain things, and he basically said, "I'll do this." And so we argued a bit.
But it apparently you didn't hold it against him.
No.
So the two of you and your son and your service dog all live in Chico. And how did you come to have a service dog?
Well, after I got back to D.C. after my final tour, I worked for a while. But as we're finding more and more, I was suffering. I had PTSD. And I went to the VA, and I had some interesting times with the VA, and I found that I wouldn't leave my house, and I was scared all the time, and my husband said we have to do something about this, and my doctors agreed, and then we found Little Angel's service dogs, and a delightful woman, Katie Gonzalez, trains these wonderful animals, and he's been with me for 5 years.
So Timothy was your therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And did they try any other therapy? I mean, I would be surprised if a doctor said, "Sylvia, here's the answer. You're going to get this dog, and then everything will be fine." Is that what the doctor said at the VA?
No, actually, what happened with the VA is I was misdiagnosed. And I was misdiagnosed and misdiagnosed, and I was basically lost for 5 years. Very, very drugged, confused, unable to function, really. Yeah, and no, They when I finally found a doctor that said, no, this horrible disease that they say you have, you don't have it. And it took a year to slowly wean me off the meds. And it took a year to figure out how to live without the meds. And that was roughly a year ago.
And so this is all recent history.
It really is, yeah. And I go through my ups and downs. I'm still struggling with PTSD and anxiety. But I have a wonderful husband, a fantastic service dog, people in the community that love me. And together we make it.
You're listening to a special membership drive edition of Nancy's Bookshelf with my guest, local poet and Army veteran, Sylvia Bowersox. Let's take a break now for information about how you can support this and other programs at North State Public Radio. And when we come back, members of Sylvia's band will join us in the studio. Welcome back to a special edition of Nancy's Bookshelf with Chico poet and musician Sylvia Bowersox. Well, I'm thinking that your writing must be therapeutic to put all this down on paper.
It feels... How do I say this? It feels like I want to tell the world this is what it was like.
Mm-hmm. Because it's hard for those of us who have not been there to imagine it. It really is hard. And you helped me be able to see really the horror of it in a way that I hadn't before. And I felt I was right there with you when I was reading these poems. I'd like you to read one of the poems now that's called 31 Bullets. And this is on page 13 in your book.
This one means so much to me. We worked with a lot of Iraqis in the palace and just in general in the mission. And so many of them were killed.
And because of working for
us? For us. And they would be targeted by insurgents, and they would get their warning, and then they'd get their other warning, or not, and then we'd get word that they were dead. And this is my sadness, and my this is dedicated to...
Your tribute to
my
Ali.
My tribute to Ali and all the other Alis and all of the other Iraqis that dreamed and died.
Okay, would you read that one for us? 31 bullets.
They killed Ali with 31 bullets at 7 o'clock this morning in his Baghdad neighborhood. He was leaving for work, his engine running, his neighbors watching. He worked with us in the palace for someone who did something important, but who mainly screamed into phones. Ali knew computers and made flyers for embassy parties he couldn't attend. His cotton shirts were always cleaned and pressed, and everyone loved him so much. We took our smoke breaks together. With our Bic lighters and cups of bad coffee, it felt so normal. He exhaled stories about his mother, his four sisters, and life in Iraq before us. And he always asked about America and if Americans liked Iraqis. I never knew what to say, so I lied. He thanked me and every American for giving him his freedom from Saddam Hussein. I smiled, never said anything, and let him light my cigarette, and let him run the back of his hand across my cheek. I should have let him kiss me that afternoon before Ramadan. Gently, I removed the tacks that hold his picture on the wall next to my desk. His smile belongs in my trailer with the others. My trailer is one of the identical white living containers facing the Tigris River, covered in sandbags and protected by well-used concrete blast walls. I fall through the door, hit the light, switch on the air conditioner, and introduce Ali to the others who thanked us for their freedom. I light a cigarette and grab the Bowie CD. Ali liked Bowie. We sink to the floor. I balance the player on my lap, hugging Ali to my chest. We hit play, and turn it all the way up. Singing along, we can be heroes, but not today. Today I cover my ears. Today I feel the music. Today I remember we're right. Today I say goodbye to my friend, but I don't cry. 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 I don't ever cry.
My guest is Sylvia Bowersox, and she has a collection of poetry and prose called Triggers about her experiences in Iraq. And Sylvia, as I'm reading this, I'm assuming that is you. You must have taken some artistic license in some of this, did you?
Sure. I'm trained as a journalist, and I know these stories, and I wanted to make them very, very, very personal. So whereas all of the stories happened, my depiction of them is fiction.
Well, because, for example, when I was reading your prose piece, Absolution, mm-hmm. it makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And I was wondering how much of that you experienced directly. You might tell people what is in this.
Absolution is about a soldier who had been out on a mission in the Kurdish areas when he got word that his hotel room, a rocket had gone through his hotel room and killed his roommate. And so he comes back to Baghdad to basically pick up the pieces. And he runs up the stairs and catches a young Iraqi man looting the room. And in the emotionality and the terror and
because here's this guy
sorrow,
stealing from
he was looting and what really got him is he had the bloody sheets and as you do, as it's a very human emotion, you see somebody, they did that, it's their fault, I will get them and then everything will be fine. And he's gonna kill him. He's got his sidearm out and he's gonna kill him. And then he smells pickles. And it reminds him of his brother. And it reminds him of the shared humanity. And his brother had a brain injury. And as so many of our service members who were shot in the head and sustained brain injury, the surgeons, the doctors were able to save him, but not really save him. He's a vegetable in this story. Mm-hmm. And through remembering the shared humanity and his brother and mourning for his brother, he is able to find the strength to let the guy go.
And not shoot him like he really wanted to.
He
felt justified. He felt that would be... He had all the right to shoot this guy, and yet he didn't.
No, he didn't, because his brother wouldn't have liked it. Mm-hmm. And it's called Absolution because at 3 a.m, he doesn't know if he did right. And he'll never know, really.
Well, now, was this person that it actually happened to able to recount this to you? I would think it would be too painful to be able to tell anybody that, but he was able to tell you what happened and what he felt and how close he came maybe to pulling the trigger and blowing that guy's brains out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was going to do it, but he was able to find the humanity and not do it. And I find that to be just such a triumph, you know, to go, all right, I have all the reasons to do this, but I'm going to do the right thing.
Well, one of your poems, you recount what it's like to be sleepless, and it's called Chant for a Long Night. And as I'm reading that, I feel like I'm sitting there awake with you. Well, go ahead. Why don't you read a little bit of that?
Well, in Baghdad, I could never sleep. And the night before missions were always very, very anxiety-ridden. Can't sleep. No, really can't sleep. No, really, 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 really can't sleep. No pills, can't sleep. No pills, can't sleep. No pills, can't sleep. Not good. Press strip, press strip, press strip, press strip. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow. Diala. No pills. Can't sleep. Not good. Not good. Not good. Not good. Diala, 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 Diala province. Dangerous. Diyala province dangerous. Diyala, Diyala, Diyala leaves, people leaves, people hanging in trees by, goats by God, boom.
And that, and then you go on to say you're really scared, and then you repeat no pills, and you're like, golly, I can't go to sleep either. And so this gives us a feel for just that this is not an unusual event. Now, some of these others might be unusual, but this, you say, this is a long night. You had long nights. Well, I want to give listeners a chance to hear your band. So I'd like to bring them into the studio.
Okay.
And we're going to hear what you create with your fellow musicians.
They killed Ali with 31 bullets at 7 o'clock this morning in his Baghdad neighborhood. He was leaving for work, his engine running, his neighbors watching. He worked with us in the palace for someone who did something important, but mainly screamed into phones. Ali knew computers and made flyers for embassy parties he couldn't attend. His cotton shirts were always cleaned and pressed, and everyone loved him so much. We took our smoke breaks together with our big lighters and cups of bad coffee. It felt so normal. He exhaled stories about his mother, his four sisters, and life in Iraq before us. And he always asked about America and if Americans liked Iraqis. I never knew what to say, so I lied. He thanked me and every American for giving him his freedom from Saddam Hussein. I smiled and never said anything. I let him light my cigarette and let him run the back of his hand across my cheek. I should have let him kiss me that afternoon before Ramadan. Gently, I removed the tacks that hold his picture on the wall next to my desk. His smile belongs in my trailer with the others. My trailer is one of the identical white living containers facing the Tigris River, covered in sandbags and protected by well-used concrete blast walls. I fall through the door, hit the light, switch on the air conditioner, and introduce Ali to the others who thanked us for their freedom. I light a cigarette and grab the Bowie CD. Ali liked Bowie. We sink to the floor. I balance the player on my lap. Hugging Ali to my chest, we hit play and turn it all the way up. Singing together, we can be heroes. But not today. Today I cover my ears. Today I feel the music. Today I remember we're right. Today I say goodbye to my friend, but I don't cry. 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 I don't ever cry.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Sylvia.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
You're listening to a special membership drive edition of Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wiegman. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, award-winning NPR correspondent Tom Gelton will tell us how the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act changed our nation. This month marks the 50th anniversary of a 1965 act whose passage has been proved to be one of the most nation-changing events in American history. Although the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act has received far less attention than the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, which were approved around the same time. My next guest has written a book that is a major contribution to the ongoing discussion about immigration in America. Veteran journalist and author Tom Gelton has won awards reporting for National Public Radio. Over a 30-year career as a correspondent for NPR News, he has covered wars in Central America, the Middle East, and the former Yugoslavia, as well as major national stories in the United States. He is a regular panelist on the PBS program Washington Week. Tom Gelton's reporting from Sarajevo was the basis for his book Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. He then wrote Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. And now his newest book has just been released. A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story, is part political history, part intimate social narrative, part economic and cultural analysis. Tom Gelton, welcome to North State Public Radio.
Nancy, it's good to be with you.
Until I read your book, I had no idea the impact of an act in 1965 on our country that I wasn't even aware of. What was the 1965 Immigration and Naturalization Act?
Well, you just explained, Nancy, why I wrote this book. This is a law that deserves far more attention than it has gotten. And to tell you the honest truth, 3 years ago, I didn't know about this act either. I think this can be ranked as one of the most monumental pieces of legislation of the 20th century, in the sense that it is largely responsible for the demographic transformation of American society over the last 50 years. So on the one hand, I wrote it simply to bring attention to this law. But secondly, I think that transformation has raised really interesting questions about America. You know, what does it mean to be an American? What is the idea of America? You know, the incorporation of people from such different backgrounds that has resulted from the passage of this act has presented us with a situation where we're actually able to explore that. You know, we had very cliched ideas, I would say, 50 years ago about what it meant to be American. Now we've been forced to really explore this question of national identity and character in a way we had not before.
Oh, yeah. I found myself asking myself those questions. Well, this act upsets some conservatives today. Why are they upset with this act?
Well, it brought in people of a different color. And I hate to say it, but, you know, I think there are some people in any society who are uncomfortable with people of different colors than themselves, people of different religions. We have a notion that America is perhaps, if not exclusively a Christian nation, then certainly a Judeo-Christian nation. So what does it mean then when you start bringing in people who aren't part of don't have a Judeo-Christian heritage? There are people who are going to be upset by that, people who think that we need to preserve our Judeo-Christian heritage. And part of preserving that would be to give priority to immigrants who reinforce that heritage. I think that's one aspect of the criticism. The other one doesn't have so much to do with the quality or the character of the immigrants, but how many immigrants are coming in. This act, by changing the rules that governed our immigration policy, opened the door to a lot of new people coming in. I mean, there are new categories of people coming in now who couldn't come in before or would have had much more difficulty coming in before. You know, now we have visas set aside for the brothers and sisters of naturalized U.S. citizens. That's a new phenomenon. Parents and children of naturalized U.S. citizens can basically come in on an unlimited basis. There are a lot of changes that were made in 1965 that have resulted in a bigger quantitative, more numbers of immigrants. And you know, that is a controversial issue.
And before 1965, most immigrants looked like me. My ancestors were from Northern Europe, and yours also. In fact, you start your book with your own family history, and we don't know it's yours. You start out with this family farm in Norway, And we learned that that was your ancestors. So this is one, another thing I like about your book is you tell personal stories that allow us to see, there's the impact of this Immigration Act.
Right. And, you know, one of the reasons that I tell my own story, Nancy, is not that I regard it so as so significant, but what I learned and you're right. I mean, in 1965, when this act was passed, 9 out of 10 immigrants were coming from Europe. So you and I aren't all that unique in that regard. Mm-hmm. But what I found interesting in exploring the history of my own ancestors coming to the United States is that the forces that drove their decision to migrate weren't all that different from the forces driving the decisions of people to migrate today. My ancestors came from Norway. The reason that my grandfather came from Norway was that there was nothing for him to do. There was no opportunity for him in Norway at the time. He lost the family farm. There were no jobs. He didn't really feel that he had a choice but to migrate. That is exactly the situation that may face some peasant from Guatemala today or somebody from sub-Saharan Africa. The forces that pushed people to leave their homeland have been largely consistent throughout history. And I wanted to emphasize that continuity because there is, unfortunately, some idea that perhaps that, you know, there are good immigrants and bad immigrants or good immigration and bad immigration. And somehow the notion that, you know, your or my ancestors had more defensible reasons to leave and come to the United States than immigrants today have. Basically, it's one continuous story.
Well, you describe a naturalization ceremony. Let me just go to that scene in a high school. And I was surprised to hear how that ceremony was conducted. Would you describe that for us?
Well, in the first place, it was big. There were 500 people who were being naturalized at that time. So when you've got this many people, you obviously can't administer the oath of citizenship on a one-by-one basis. So you have someone up on the stage who leads the group in reciting the oath of citizenship. One of the things that I found interesting was that before they did that, they read out a list of the countries from which those immigrants had come and were being naturalized. And they asked the people to stand up when they heard their country named. And the roll call of countries was very impressive because the vast majority of countries were ones from which it was very hard to immigrate before 1965. As I recall, I don't have the book in front of me right now, but I think the three top countries were like Pakistan, Ethiopia, and India, maybe something like that. None of those countries were ones that were allowed to send very many immigrants to the United States before 1965. So looking out on that group of people being naturalized as U.S. citizens. You saw women in headscarves, hijabs. You saw men in skull caps. You saw faces of many different colors. And it was just, to me, a very vivid scene of how the sort of the character of America's immigrant population has changed.
Well, and then we wonder, these immigrants who become American citizens, are they going to genuinely embrace our American ideology?
Well, it depends on how narrowly you define that ideology. I mean, if you define that ideology as sort of incorporating Judeo-Christian religious traditions, maybe not. I mean, the largest single group of immigrants coming into the country today are Asian. And many Asian immigrants, many are Christian, there are many who come from either a Buddhist or a Hindu tradition. You have one of the fastest growing immigrant groups in the United States today are immigrants from Muslim majority countries who are Muslim by their faith tradition. So if you define that American ideology in those kind of semi-religious terms, no. The answer is no. But if you define that American ideology as believing sort of in individualism, if the idea that you can advance on the basis of your own individual merit, if you subscribe to the freedoms enshrined in the Bill of Rights, if you believe those, if you believe in the U.S. Constitution, if you believe in really all the principles of American citizenship, then I think the answer is yes. There's no reason why people from different backgrounds cannot accept and embrace and incorporate that American ideology.
Well, for example, some citizens feel that English, we should insist that they speak English. At that naturalization ceremony, the lady conducting it said, yes, speak English, but you don't have to give up your native language and customs and religion.
I think that's right. And I'll tell you something, Nancy. I found in, and again, the people that I focus on in this book have come within the law. These are not people that sneaked across the border or overstayed the visas. These are people who waited their turn, followed the rules, and came here legally. And I found, by and large, all of them thought that English, that everybody should speak English. I talked to one Bolivian family who said that they came here, when they came here in the 1980s, you know, if they called up their cable company to switch on their cable, they're not going to get some operator who spoke Spanish. Nowadays, they point out, you call up a cable operator and you just have to press 2 and you get a Spanish-speaking operator. They didn't like that. They thought it was better when they came here because the services were available only in English, and it forced them to learn English. So, you know, this is a very divisive issue, but I have found that many, many immigrants have no problem with English being a requirement of citizenship in this country. That doesn't mean that they feel that they should be ashamed of their traditions or stop speaking their language or anything like that. You know, they believe that you should, on the one hand, hold on to your traditions and your heritage and your culture and your language, but also learn to speak English and adapt to American society.
Well, one last question, Tom. And that is the title of your book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story, you borrowed from Walt Whitman.
I did. Walt Whitman wrote a poem. It's the preface to Leaves of Grass. I think it was published in the middle of the 19th century, somewhere around 1855 or so, in which he said the United States is essentially a great poem. He said, not only a nation, but a teeming nation of nations. And what interested me about that quote is it wasn't true. It wasn't true at that time, and it wasn't true for another 100 years after that. We weren't a nation of nations. We were largely a nation of European immigrants. And it's only been in the last 50 years that that idea of America as a nation of nations has actually become a reality. So there's something sort of ironic in my choice of that title.
My guest has been NPR News correspondent Tom Gelton, and his latest book is A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Thank you so much, Tom.
Good to be with you, Nancy.
I would also like to thank my first guest, Army veteran, poet, and musician Sylvia Bowersox. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.